The topics and opinions expressed in the following show are solely those of the hosts and their guests and not those of W4CY Radio, its employees, or affiliates. We make no recommendations or endorsements for radio show programs, services, or products mentioned on air or on our web. No liability, explicit or implied, shall be extended to W4CY Radio or its employees or affiliates. Any questions or comments should be directed to those show hosts. Thank you for choosing W4CY Radio.
Well, hello and welcome to the Connected Table Live. We're your hosts, Melanie Young and David Ransom, your insatiably curious culinary couple. Each week we bring you the dynamic people who work front and center and behind the scenes in food, wine, spirits, and hospitality. We lead a delicious life and we love sharing it with all of our friends around the world. This is a global show and you're listening live today, January 23rd, snowy day where I am in the Hudson Valley and W4CY Radio. But you can listen to all our shows. They become podcasts after the live show to iHeart.com, iTunes, and wherever major podcasts you can download. So you can listen to them anywhere, anytime. We love sharing stories of the people who really shape our industry. And while many of you know we have interviewed tons of vintners around the world, we just love it when we can snare time with some top chefs and restaurateurs because they are the hardest people to schedule because they run restaurants and it is a 24/7 business. Not that the winemaking business isn't, but the restaurant business is tough and it's tougher now than ever. We're really excited about today's guest. I'm flying solo unless David calls in from Brazil where he's learning about wine. Go figure. But otherwise, I'm flying solo today, and I'm kind of selfishly glad I am because this topic hits home to me. We were recently in Philadelphia during our road trip, and I love Philadelphia. I think it's just one of the best restaurant cities in the United States, and I can't believe we haven't been there more often. It's just a hop, skip, and a jump by Amtrak. But we stopped just for the night, just to eat at this one restaurant. In fact, We had a reservation on a Monday. I decided I wanted to go on a Sunday because I was just tired of driving. And I called the restaurant and the very nice receptionist told me, I said, where can I stay? Just right by your restaurant. I just want to eat at the restaurant. And she said, go across the street to the Sheraton or whatever it was. I think it was a Sheraton. And we literally booked our hotel around this restaurant. I'm talking about Zahav, which is just one of the greatest restaurants in the United States and defines modern Israeli cuisine, which I think is kind of an interesting term because when I grew up in a Southern Jewish family in Chattanooga, Tennessee, our family's Ashkenazi. I call this Ashkenazi because we ate so much. And I grew up eating the only, quote, Israeli food or what we call Jew food because we didn't know any better. We were stupid. We ate a lot of chopped liver. We ate simis. We ate noodle kugel. We ate brisket. We ate meatball and cabbage and something called tongue, which I refused to eat. And I didn't really like any of the desserts, particularly the Passover ones. They all stank. So we usually just had peach pie and southern things instead. But that was my background. And my grandmother decided I needed to become a little more faithful in my life. So at 16, she shipped me off to Israel to learn about my heritage. I spent more time probably researching the handsome men I met along the way because Israeli men are so handsome. But I got to stay at a kibbutz. I went to Jerusalem. I went to Haifa. I went to the Dead Sea. I went to the Red Sea. I went to where they say Jesus was born. That was like awesome. I went to where the Last Supper was. I went to some amazing historical places, and I've never sadly been back. So I'm really excited to be able to dive into a topic that interests me, which is modern Israeli cooking and really what defines it, because the food is amazing. And one of the reasons I've had the good fortune to try it here in the United States is thanks to today's guests. We're talking about Michael Solomonoff and Stephen Cook, who are partners in Cook & Solo, which is a restaurant company that owns several great restaurants in Philadelphia. And its flagship is Zahav, which is modern, as they say, modern Israeli cuisine, which I'm going to let them talk about. And the book in front of me that I'm looking at is the gorgeous book, Israeli Soul. easy, essential, delicious. I want to give a shout out to the book's producer, Dorothy Kalin, who's one of the great talents in the publishing world and food and beverage, who helped work on it. And I'm honored to have Michael Solomonoff and Stephen Cook today on the Connected Table Live. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Well, I got to tell you, we had a great meal at Zahav. We ate at the bar. The bartender gave us some great cocktails to try because we're really into that. And you had a nice wine list. We were really kind of psyched about that since we write about wine as well. But I have to say, you know, first of all, I'd like to start with a little backstory. You guys come from kind of different ends of the world, right? And you came together through a common interest, which is wonderful. Let's start with you, Michael. Give us a little of your backstory, where you grew up and why you decided to become a chef.
So I grew up in Squirrel Hill, Pittsburgh, even though I was born in Israel. My family moved to Israel. My mom was American, my dad Israeli, but from Bulgaria. And then, so I had like a pretty normal sort of, you know, like Jewish American life. And Pittsburgh, as you probably know, Squirrel Hill is like a little shtetl. So it was very, you know, there was like a lot of like Judaism and, it wasn't so weird to have like an Israeli dad, even though my dad was like pretty weird. But we moved back to Israel when I was 15, and then I sort of got the bug, you know, and I didn't feel necessarily American or Israeli. And I ended up moving back to the States by myself, dropped out of school in University of in New England, and then moved back to Israel, and then just got a job working like in a bakery. And then a short order cook, not because I wanted to be a chef, but because it was sort of the only job that I was really qualified for, and I fell in love with it, and that is what started me cooking.
I love the fact that you're self-trained and you worked your way through by doing the work. I have great respect for that, and one of the things I love about this industry, particularly the restaurant industry, is you have that opportunity, and that's so awesome. Stephen, what about you? Where did you grow up, and what you were in like investment banking? Like, goodness gracious, you had a huge like, reinvention. Tell us about that.
Yeah, pretty unlikely. I grew up in Miami, which is actually so far south that it's actually north, kind of like a suburb of Manhattan and Tel Aviv put together. But I came to Philadelphia to go to school originally, and I went to school for finance and did what we were supposed to do when we graduated, which was become investment bankers, and I did that for about 6 years in New York, I think knowing for most of that time that it wasn't something that I wanted to make a career out of. And I had always had an interest in cooking, both through my family growing up and as a hobby in New York. And I just said, why not? Let me go to culinary school. I'll go at night while I'm working. And if I love it, then I know what I want to do with my life. And that's exactly what happened. I fell in love with culinary school, and a year later I was back in Philly, and just sort of the scene here was really just starting to really take off, and feel lucky to have come to Philly at that moment and to have met Mike, you know, within a couple of years of both of us getting here.
So I'm curious, what culinary school did you go to, and what timing is this when Philly was just taking off?
So it used to be called the French Culinary Institute.
Oh, ICC, yeah.
Yeah. Back when French, so they had to change the name because I guess French cooking isn't what it once was. So that was in 2000. I graduated from there and I came to Philly in 2001.
Okay. So just so you know, I was consulting for Dorothy, the late, great Dorothy Hamilton at the time on the French Culinary Institute. And the reason that they changed it was right about that time, 2001. If you remember, there was the anti-freedom fries, anti-French. People were like booing French for some crazy reason, and it was hurting them. And so we all, as a consultant, we all decided to rebrand it as International Culinary Center, and it thrives today. But it was a weird time in our life. As we all know, 2001 was a defining year for many of us.
Sure.
You each came together, and Michael, you'd been working with Mark Vetri, another great Philadelphia restaurant. Stephen, at that time, what were you doing? And were you in Philadelphia, or are you elsewhere? Are you still in investment banking?
I was in Philly. I actually opened a small restaurant in West Philly called Marigold Kitchen,
okay,
which is where I was when Mark and I met. And I was actually looking for a chef to take over in the kitchen. And that's how we started working together.
Somebody else I interviewed on the show worked for Marigold Kitchen. That's going to make me crazy trying to figure out who it was. But that name has come up. Michael, you made a pretty, you know, we are all affected by things that happen in our life. I will share mine and then I want you to share yours. I had a very successful public relations business for many years, and I started the James Beard Awards, which of course I know you've won as Outstanding Chef Mid-Atlantic and Outstanding Chef in 2017. And then I, in 2009, was diagnosed with breast cancer. My father was dying of cancer, and after coming through that horrific experience and realizing I was killing myself, pushing myself too hard and what I was doing, I changed my life. And here I am now doing this and writing and focusing on healthy eating and living. You had a similar life changing experiences that made you refocus on what you're doing today. Would you like to share a little bit out of it just to kind of add a little inspiration to those out there who may be thinking, what am I doing with my life?
No, yeah, definitely. And congratulations to you. And I'm glad that you adjusted and changed. And it's nice to hear that you're healthy and you sound
Thank you.
Like you're actually enjoying what it is that you're doing.
I do.
And that's a huge thing. I my little brother, David, was killed serving in the military in Israel. And that sort of independently of that, but definitely not affected. I'm also a recovering drug addict, and I was not. I was an active drug addict after he died. So many years of grief, many years of continued recovery. And a lot of that, a lot of the success really has to do with the people that you have in your life. And Steve Cook being, probably the most important person in that. And he found out 2 years after us being in business together, or maybe 3 years, but only a few months after we opened Zaha, that I had been hiding a drug addiction and was, whereas probably a lot of people distance, sort of legally and personally, he was the first to sort of intervene and drive me along with my ex-wife to rehab. Mm-hmm. And then, for the next year, from 12-step meetings and me into work and be a friend, a mentor, a brother, all those things. To this day, it's obviously not, early recovery is probably the hardest thing I've ever really gone through, and also grieving death and, raising kids. And, we sort of live life together, and I think that is has been the secret to whatever kind of success. It's just finding people that are in your corner.
And I congratulate you Michael, I congratulate you for being open about it, because a lot of people aren't. And I hid my cancer for 2 years. I was so embarrassed. So it is very hard.
I'm really sorry.
Yeah, it really is hard. So for all the reasons you don't want people to run away. So the fact that you have been open and encourages other people is awesome. And it also grounded you into deciding what really mattered to you. And of course, losing your little brother 3 days before he was to complete his military career is devastating. And I know that, you go back and go to the site often to remember him. And Stephen, in your situation, I admire you because you were, obviously investment banking is a very lucrative business. You could just go and take the money and run, but you realized that your heart and soul was in something else. And I think why I wanted to segue here with that to, show how human celebrity chefs and successful people are, that there is pain in the process, is that it shows that you can go home again and you can reboot if you need to. You don't have to be doing the same thing. So kudos to both of you. And somebody just asked on the screen, why would you hide cancer? You would hide cancer the same way you would hide a drug addiction or anything that you consider that people would look at you and consider a weakness. It's not. It happens to you, but the strength is that you recover. So I hope that answers the question in the chat room. I want to go into so this leads to Israeli cooking, because this is really where you found your touchstone and have built together a very successful mini empire with, I think you have 6 restaurants. Somebody asked, and that it is what you really ask in the beginning of Israeli Soul, what is Israeli cooking? Because that's a strange question. It's like, what is American cooking, right?
Yeah, it's a really complicated, sort of layered answer that we're going to, I think, Steve, you should take
this one. I like to think of, you know, Israel itself as a country is a very complex story to tell. And I think food is actually a way to illuminate the story of Israel in a way that people can understand. I mean, you're talking about a piece of land that is one of the oldest inhabited pieces of land on earth. It's where ancient winemaking, ancient agriculture all came from, that area. And yet the country is 70 years old. And so right. Since 1948 and in the decades leading up to that, you've had Jews coming from literally all 4 corners of the earth, right? Bringing something in common, which is being Jewish, but also bringing what they gathered in the diaspora, food traditions that they gathered from their hosts in the diaspora, bringing it back to a place that already had a very well-established food culture, you know, Palestinian and you know, Eastern Mediterranean traditions. And it all kind of intermingles and, you know, cross breeds. And so you can't, you know, a lot of people equate Israeli food with Middle Eastern food, but the reality is much more complicated and diverse. You have North Africa, you have Eastern Europe, you have the Balkans, you have, you know, the Persian Gulf. It's really a melting pot, not too different actually than the American story. Mm-hmm. So I think it's neat to trace these traditions from as far away as you can get from Israel and how they came back and reintroduced things, you know, to the region, and creating this cuisine that is like literally changing every time we go back.
Well, you know, just like American, so-called American, it's like if you asked an American from different parts of the United States, what is American cooking to them, the answer would be different based on where you grew up. And I think it's the same with Israel, because it is a land, Israel was created 70 years ago, just over, as a state, and people moved into it. But yet there's this ancient cultures that were in that land for many, many years. And what I love is how you illustrate it in the book. For those who are curious and don't quite understand still what the food is, let's illustrate some what we would call, I know signature dishes is tough, but there are certain things that definitely are common threads. So let's talk about those. And some of them are very common in the United States, and you just don't really think about them as coming from Israel.
Yeah, definitely. I sumac to me is always the fun ingredient to discuss, you know, because it really, so there was no real, the sour flavor that was used in Middle Eastern cooking, before the Moors brought lemons was sumac, right? Which, is not poisonous. That's kind of the first question that everybody asks when they bring it to the table. We're not trying to poison you right before your meal. We wait till afterwards, but sumac grows wild here, you know, all over Pennsylvania and New Jersey. And sumac was the original pink lemonade that the Pennsylvania Dutch kind of took or stole from the Native Americans to make what is now pink lemonade that we drink. Before it was just the sumac beverage. So I find these sort of the overlap and the consistencies and discussion about, you know, cultural appropriation and this and that to be really relevant, because food really comes from nowhere, or it comes from everywhere. But I think that sumac is a big one. I mean, we use tons of za'atar, obviously, in the restaurant, which is hard. Now there's farmers that are growing it for us. It's got a super short season here in Pennsylvania. I would imagine California's got a little bit more, but za'atar is a really tricky one. Steve, what do you think?
I mean, the thing, I think the dish that we talk about a lot that actually is a good illustration of what Israeli cuisine is the sandwich called tabbikh. which is essentially a fried eggplant sandwich. It's Iraqi in origin. The ingredients were brought over by Iraqi immigrants to Israel in the 50s, but it didn't become a dish until it got to Israel. It's essentially elements of the Iraqi Sabbath afternoon meal, treated to the Israeli treatment of stuffing it inside of a pita, because Israelis love to just take whatever, you know, they'll stuff anything inside of a pita. And so you've got these elements from this Iraqi Sabbath stew. You've got this Iraqi condiment called amba, which is a pickled mango condiment, which itself is a fascinating story, because the Iraqis were big traders in India and all the way into the Far East, and they brought back this this mango condiment that they picked up in India. That became Iraqi. The Iraqis brought it to Israel. Now you have this sandwich, which is really, I think, by Israelis considered to be right up there with like falafel and shawarma as like the sandwich, that was born in Israel, but has ingredients from Iraq, has ingredients from India. And more than that, now amba, in addition to being a condiment on this specific sandwich, you'll find amba at every falafel stand in the country and a condiment on every table. So it's these things that were never there, were never in Israel before. Now all of a sudden they're there and they're everywhere. And that's kind of a great example of what the kind of dish that makes up what has become Israeli cuisine.
So amba, I'm looking on, you have a classic mango amba, but you also have in Israeli soul, apple amba, strawberry amba. So amba itself is trying to visualize it for our listeners. It's a liquid. So it's a liquid. It's a sauce, right? It's a sauce.
It's a sauce meets pickle meets chutney.
Okay, so it's a liquid chutney. It's a liquidified chutney-ish thing. So
I feel like when you have it in restaurants in Israel, it is like a little bit sweet and it's saucy. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But the mango pickle that we know from like Indian food, sort of before I think it got to Iraq, was more of like a chutney, right? It's like chunky a little bit. Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I mean, this was my first. I got to tell you, looking at your book and thinking about my listener right now, I think about it. I thought it was interesting how you talk about the beginning of the book. So I learned a lot from the book that I didn't know. And one of the things you talk about in the beginning of the book is falafel really Israeli at all? I mean, it's a conundrum, you say. For our listeners who may not quite understand the difference, what's the difference between a falafel, a shawarma, and a ceviche?
Well, falafel are chickpea fritters. Shawarma is layered, kind of like upright rotisserie, meat. Usually, like lamb, chicken, turkey, that kind of thing. And then sabich is a fried eggplant that is stuffed inside a pita with eggs and amba and tahina.
Well, they're all stuffed inside pitas, correct?
Yeah, well, yes and no. I mean, falafel, I think that what makes it sort of Israeli is the stuffing inside of the pita. Not to say that like other countries do that, but really the sort of portability of it and the sandwich making of it is what makes it a little bit more Israeli, if you will. Sabich is, sabich was invented, I guess, to be in a sandwich.
I just think it's interesting because you see variations of these throughout when you travel around the world, right? Mm-hmm. So it's interesting to see them actually defined in this book to really explain their origins. I found that really, really interesting reading the book. I was also fascinated and happy, and one of the reasons I'm falling in love with Israeli cooking is that salads are a big mainstay. I think you've got like three picture pages of salads. All of them look phenomenal. A lot of that's because the produce is so readily available, but is Israeli a salad culture as well?
I think it absolutely is. I mean, it's a very small country the size of New Jersey. You know, everything, you don't have to say things are local. I mean, everybody knows that everything is local. Nothing comes from more than 100 miles away. You know, it's there's something about the produce over there that just, you can taste how fresh and how recently it was in the ground. And I think that dovetails nicely with sort of the Middle Eastern and Israeli approach to hospitality, because the first thing that happens when you sit down to eat at almost any Israeli restaurant, no matter how lowbrow or highbrow it is that before you order any food, all this food comes to the table, and it's like a dozen salads. They're all super fresh, vibrant, healthy. They stimulate your appetite without making you feel like you've got to go to the gym. And they all, you know, all of them come from a different part of the world. So they're, you sort of start a meal at Israel with this like edible history lesson of the different cultures that make up, you know, the food that you're eating.
And that's usually when I blow it, because I usually eat all the small plates and then
yeah,
I'm not
that's what
hungry.
We all do.
Yeah. It happens wherever I travel, Italy, Asia. I have to tell you, I have like, I'm the salad maker in the duo here. David handles the proteins because I tend to be more vegetable focused in my dining. And you've got some dishes here that I'm just salivating over. Lima beans with tomato and cinnamon. As a Southerner, I just love lima beans. So add cinnamon. I put cinnamon in everything. That just sounds divine. I haven't tried that yet, but that is so on my salad repertoire, along with pickled beets and pistachios. I like pickled beets. David doesn't. And I'm just crazy for pistachios and whatnot. Before we go to the break, I want to talk about chickpeas, because chickpeas are kind of like the Smith, you know, it's like the most common, they're essential. And but it's not just about hummus. I mean, let's talk about chickpeas in the cuisine.
Yeah, I mean, chickpeas are pretty important. You know, tahina is probably the most important thing, but chickpeas are really important, obviously, for the hummus and for falafel. So they do a lot, and they also do, I mean, they sort of promote the vegan, or they round out the vegan protein vibe that you sort of go for. So chickpeas are very, very important, but I would argue that tahina is probably the most important.
Which I happen to love, but for those who may not know what it is listening, explain what it is.
It's just the sesame puree.
I put it on everything. Okay. I love it on my cauliflower. Yeah. I spread it. I use it instead of peanut butter. Unfortunately, it has quite a bit of calories in it. I learned as I was spreading it everywhere, but I love it. And we had Adina Sussman on our show just to talk about tahina on her little single subject book. It was like awesome. Wonderful. If you've not tried tahina, it is really, stop eating peanut butter now and switch to tahina, right? Put it in your noodle. You will never go back to peanut butter again. Seriously. I want to take a very short break, and then I want to dive into, first, I want to talk about your restaurants, and also I'm going to ask a little bit more about anyone who wants to go to Israel and understand the different areas of Israeli cooking and if there's a regionality we should address. You're listening to the Connected Table Live, and this is your chance also to send me questions at w4cy.com to ask Michael and Steve. And we're talking again with Michael Solomonoff and Stephen Cook. The book is Israeli Soul. The restaurant is Zahav, but they have many more, which you're going to learn about in a few seconds. We'll be right back. We're back. You're listening to the Connected Table Live. I'm your host, Melanie Young. David is off in Brazil drinking what they call Prosecco, which the Italians are cringing about because it's only Prosecco if it's made in Italy, but apparently they create a version in Brazil. I'm with Michael Solomonoff and Steve Cook, who are co-owners of several restaurants in Philadelphia, which we're going to talk about. We mentioned Zahav, which is modern Israeli cooking, where Dave and I ate at the bar recently, and it was divine. Everybody needs to beeline it. And also want to remind you that all our shows are permanently podcast to iHeart.com and the free iHeart app. You can listen anywhere in the world. And if you can't get on iHeart, you can go to iTunes or any podcast platform. So Michael and Steven, you have a company in Philadelphia called Cook In Solo. Tell us about your restaurants. We've talked about Zahav. Tell us, let's start with Abe Fisher.
I like to think of Abe. Go ahead, Mike.
You got it. No, you got it, Steve.
I like to think of Abe Fisher as the inverse Zahav. I mean, Zahav looks at the food of the Jewish people through the lens of Israel, and Abe Fisher is basically the Jewish food from the diaspora. So it's sort of the inverse, and it's kind of like the Ashkenazi tradition that I think in America we most closely associate with Jewish food, the schmaltzy stuff, and we try to do some fun and elevated takes on that that overlooked cuisine. So that's Abe Fisher.
Well, overlooked or underappreciated. So give us some examples, because I grew up on some of that schmaltzy food. I didn't particularly love all of it, but I love some of it just because I never got into tongue. But I bet you do a better job than whoever was doing it for my grandmother. So tell us, give us an idea of some dishes for our listeners.
Well, we do serve tongue sometimes. So next time you're in town, we'll have to make sure we have it on the menu. Our signature dish is it's a whole plate of short ribs that we treat in the sort of Montreal style of smoked meat. We cure it for a long time. We smoke it and then we cook it. And that's like the centerpiece of our big tasting menu there. So it's sort of like, you know, the best pastrami you've ever had. And, you know, we also like, we have a dessert that's been on the menu since the beginning is called bacon and egg cream. And it's sort of like it's a play on the egg cream, but also a play on like our people's sort of flirtation with treif, with non-kosher food, especially here in America where, you know, they're largely, or, you know, fairly secular and integrated in society. So it's like a maple custard with a bacon and chocolate cookie crumble. And then we do like a chocolate foam on top, to sort of mimic the experience of drinking an egg cream.
Oh, wow. That sounds decadent. So it's definitely not a kosher restaurant. it is an equal opportunity dining restaurant. Abe Fisher. Abe Fisher. I actually write for Jewish Week on the side, and I don't keep kosher either. And I was like, you know, it's so funny how I end up writing for the craziest outlets just because. Let's talk about your humiseria. Is that how you pronounce a humiseria? I know that. Is that how you pronounce it? A humiseria?
Yeah, humiseria.
Yes.
Humiseria.
Uh-huh.
Humusia. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that exists in Israel, and that's just the hummus stall. And usually it's a couple rondos or pots of chickpeas, sort of like a blender and pita, and it's like exactly what it sounds. I think every slice of society eats hummus, and every sort of socioeconomic, you know, group eats hummus as well, and it's basically like... you know, it's like the best street food ever. And, you know, when they run out of chickpeas, they close the doors, and that's kind of it, you know. So we wanted to, when we decided to open Dizengoff, it was when we were opening Abe Fisher, and we weren't confident that people would, like, get just eating hummus. And people came to the Hobbs to have hummus and salad, and then they kind of stayed for the rest, you know, and we weren't sure how people would sort of take it. So we opened Dizengoff next to Abe Fisher in the event people didn't get the home, but at least we'd have another full service restaurant next to it. And we have been super successful there and are really busy. And we make pita by hand, which is awesome. And we make batches of hummus throughout the day, and it's as delicious as you'd expect. You know, it's really, really good, really small, really fun. And we've got a good relationship with a bunch of farms, and we do like little hummus toppings, which are a bit nouveau. In Israel, there's not a lot. I mean, there's, you know, obviously like garnish and toppings, but it doesn't like rotate. And we use probably a lot of things that would end up on salads over there as the sort of center, you know, sort of, we like frame the Brussels sprouts, for example, with like hazelnuts and then do the hummus tahin outside of that. So it's a bit more of like a composed meal.
Well, your hummus was divine at Zahav. I mean, we kind of snorfed it down. We make it at home. David does. I don't. David does, and he also does it with, he does one with carrots and chickpeas. And your pita bread, was it the pita? I don't know if that was pita bread that you come out of the oven, or is that a different type of flatbread?
No, that's a laffa at Zahav. That's an Iraqi thing.
It's like an elephant. For those listening, it's like a charred elephant ear. Kind of, it's, they're huge and floppy, and that's what I kept. They it was divine, and really a great way to serve if you're entertaining. I know you have a easy recipe. Well, I hope it's easy recipe for pita bread in Israeli soul, because David is a bread baker, so he loves to try different breads. We never buy bread anymore. We only bake here at Camp David. You have also, what restaurant am I missing? Goldie. What is Goldie?
Goldie is our falafel shop.
Okay.
Which we opened in about a year ago, a little more than a year ago. Mm-hmm. So Zahav is the Hebrew word for gold.
Right.
So Goldie is sort of the diminutive, and it's like Zahav's little cousin. So we kind of wanted to take the Israeli falafel stand, which is ubiquitous, and translate it, you know, for America. And we kind of think of it like the Middle Eastern hamburger stand. So we do falafel sandwiches, we do french fries, and then we do tahina milkshakes. So the whole place is vegan.
Oh, yum.
And the you know, the fat in the tahina takes the place of the butter fat in ice cream. And we make these vegan shakes that are absolutely delicious, and I think people like maybe even more than they like the falafel.
Wow, it sounds really, really good. And these are like easy takeouts and affordable and really filling as well. So great, great to eat any time of the day. You have two other places, Federal Donuts and the Rooster, which has a nonprofit tied to it. Tell us about those.
I think we might have... Mike, are you still there? I think we might have lost Mike.
Oh, where'd he go? Well, hopefully he'll be back. Hopefully he'll be back. Okay, Steve, we have Steven. Well, hopefully Mike will be back. Yeah. Okay.
So Federal Donuts is it is a donut shop, but it also serves fried chicken.
Hey.
Mike, he's back. Hi, back.
I'm back.
Yes, okay.
You were like, I hope that pita is easy. And I was like, exit.
You're back. So we're going to talk about Federal Donuts briefly, and then the Rooster, which is your nonprofit focused restaurant.
Mike, you want to take Federal?
Yeah, so Federal is, so we opened Federal with five partners, and we were all kind of friends. And it was right after we had opened a second pretty big restaurant that was like not making any money. I think we all kind of put a couple thousand dollars into a pot, with the idea that we would help our friends who owned a really successful coffee shop open a coffee shop with donuts. And we were just eating like tons of fried chicken, Korean fried chicken wings at the time. Mm. And we thought we would just basically get a fryer and be able to make donuts and chicken and serve coffee. And none of us really expected it to work. It was almost like a joke in a way. And then on day two, we were like, wow, this might be the best thing we've ever done. So we were super busy, and it was very, very low overhead, and it was sort of the start of our approach to, I think, a lot of our concepts, which are just really making a few things as best as possible and really limiting the offerings and just making, and, you know, having the best coffee, having the best donuts, and having the best fried chicken, and having really good value for our guests, which is important at every one of our restaurants, and providing excellent service. And that's the open Federal Donuts. And then day two, we were like, wow, this is going to make it longer than a week. And then a year later, we opened one, and now we've got five of them.
Well, you know, it's funny when you just appeal to the basic food groups that people just love emotionally, fried chicken, donuts, coffee, just add pizza and you're going to be like, you know, rolling in bill. You'll be like the Jeff Bezos of food, because, I mean, pizza people make a ton of money. I heard they're the biggest high profit or high whatever margin, or not whatever, but I hear they're big money makers, pizza places. Have you ever thought about opening a pizza place, even though I know it didn't quite fit in the diaspora?
I'm thinking about it now.
Yeah. not until you mentioned that, you know? Yeah.
Well, you could do these great flatbread pieces, you know? I mean, to me, that would be like the next move. Brilliant. Because they are money makers. Speaking of money, we are in a weird time in our country where people are actually in food lines. I can't even believe it. The Rooster donates 100% of its profits to Broad Street Ministry Hospitality Collaborative. Tell us about that.
So Rooster is a project that we started, the federal donut started with Broad Street. Broad Street mm-hmm. provides, I think, over 70,000 meals to Philadelphians experiencing hunger. Philadelphia is a very poor city, as great a city as it is on many levels, it's also very poor. So we partnered with them. As Federal Donuts was growing, we were going through so much chicken, and we were throwing out mountains of chicken bones, you know, fresh chicken we'd butcher for frying, and we would throw away the carcasses. And we just thought we had to do something better with it. And after a couple of iterations, we landed on the Rooster, which is basically a Jewish deli / diner. We've prominently featured soup on the menu, and that soup is made from this former Federal Donuts waste product. So we make broth out of those bones, turn that into soup. That's part of the menu at the restaurant. You or I or anybody comes in, eats lunch like they would any other day, and they know that the profits from that lunch are basically going to feed someone else, because 100% of the profits of the restaurant go to Broad Street to help them fulfill their mission of providing hospitality for the people in our city who are the least likely to receive it.
Oh, I just love that. First of all, I love it on every level because I detest food waste, and I've done a lot of shows on that on my other show. And the carcasses of chickens make great broth. We do it all the time here. You should see our place after Thanksgiving. It's like, you want to go, who got killed? I mean, there's just bones everywhere. And it makes amazing broth that we freeze and reuse. And it's just awesome. And the fact that you're doing this to help people who are less, who have less, is amazing, because now more than ever, we need that in our country. There are a lot of people doing really well, but there are a lot of people who are suffering, and it's everywhere. And if you know, I'm sorry that Philadelphia is that way, because it's such an amazing city. It really is. For any of you who have not been to Philadelphia, go. It is so fabulous. The food's great, but the history of our country is there's a lot of it there. You've got to go see it. And one of the best, I love the Barnes Collection Museum. It's amazing. It's just an amazing museum. I want to talk. We have a little time left. I want to talk about, for anyone who wants to go to Israel, I confessed at the beginning of the show that I went as a teenager, an unappreciative teenager, and now Dave and I want to go back so badly. And I'm lucky, one of my relatives actually has business in Israel, Jonathan, and I'll be sending him the show. He does stuff that he can't talk about, which means he probably does stuff for the high-level Israeli government officials, but he always has said, he'll fix you up and hook you up when you go. Of course, I think Michael Solomonoff and Stephen Cook hooking us up would even better. What is the differences? Give us an idea of the regionality of the food in Israel and where you would go if you were going for the first time.
I don't know. I mean, it's, you cannot help but to run into like amazing food culture and stories. I mean, I would say probably start in Tel Aviv and, eat as many of the small little places. I mean, what's cool, like Yaffa is amazing because not only is it got like the sort of most original urban like Palestinian food, but it's got all the immigrants that ended up in Israel basically came through, especially in like early in, Israeli independence, came through Yaffa. So there's still remnants of like Bulgarian, Romanian. There's an amazing Libyan restaurant there. And it's awesome. There's great hummus. It's beautiful. It's just really beautiful. And then you can walk essentially everywhere, which is cool. And Tel Aviv is super vibrant. And I don't know. It's just really awesome. And then I think that, like, obviously Jerusalem is great too. And now there's, like, very good restaurants there. And before it used to be a little bit sleepy, but there's a restaurant in like the Iraqi part of the market, Machane Yehuda, which is, there's a restaurant there called Azura, which is like, I don't know, maybe one of my favorite places to eat like on earth. It's just so good, and it's got Kurdish, Iraqi, and like a lot of Turkish influence in their food. And it's been open for, I don't know, it seems like the 60s. That Azura's been open for the 60s, since the 60s.
Hmm.
Yeah, so.
Well, I believe so.
Well, you know, for those who, I have the map of Israel out. It's a long country. It borders the Mediterranean Sea. And when Mike is talking about Tel Aviv, it is on the sea. It's actually very beachy. I remember when I was there, it was like very disco-y and it was fun. I liked it better than the kibbutz. I actually left the kibbutz to go back to Tel Aviv. I thought it was like really one of the cool.
But they all do.
Yeah. Particularly after day one, you're planting and you're going to wake up at 4:30. I'm like, no, but it was a great experience, the kibbutz, but I like Tel Aviv better. Jerusalem is awe-inspiring. I mean, you go there and you cannot help but feel this spirituality, because so many people go to the Wailing Wall, which is so amazing, and it's a powerful experience. It really, really is. And I bet the food markets are incredible, right?
Yeah, they're amazing.
So what about north toward Galilee and Haifa and the Golan Heights, which has some really amazing winery areas and vineyards? What's the food like up there further north, closer to Lebanon?
Steve, you want to take this one, bro?
You can talk about the food if you want. I can talk about the wine.
It sounds like a great plan. So sort of the north, the, you know, you get into more of like a northern, like Levant, Lebanese, northern Galilee, which is super herbaceous.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost got like a Tuscan vibe to it. I mean, everywhere in Israel is like tons of herbs, but this is really, it gets a bit colder, it gets more rain, and it's more hilly. So you can, you know, the strength and potency of the herbs is, it's just everything's like a bit more fragrant, and there's a lot of like braised lamb, and you know, it's things that you would sort of expect, a lot of like pine nuts, mushrooms, that kind of thing. You know, then you sort of like see Druze culture, which is really amazing Levantine food. A lot of really amazing farms actually too in the Galilee as well. Produce is awesome.
And the wines?
Well, the Galilee is kind of the epicenter of the modern Israeli wine industry. I mean, the Rothschilds, back I think in the late 1800s, provided funding for growing wine grapes again in Israel. But it was mostly for ceremonial wine, and it was pretty not necessarily drinkable. But back in the 80s, there was a relationship established with the winemaking program at UC Davis. And a lot of that California, Northern California winemaking expertise was brought over to Israel, and the climate in the Galilee, the you know, day-night temperature differentials. It's Israel. In Israel, they consider the Galilee to be sort of the Bordeaux, and then in the hills around Jerusalem is quote unquote the Burgundy. But the number of boutique wineries in Israel, I think, has gone from a few dozen to several hundred in the last 15 or 20 years. So there's really been a renewed interest in making very high quality table wine as opposed to just sort of kosher ceremonial wine there.
Absolutely. We've had Victor Schoenfeld on our mini podcast series with Golan Heights Winery and Mika Vadia. I'm from Galil Mountain Winery, and then Jack Capsudo, who was a restaurateur in New York and then lost his restaurant after Hurricane Sandy, was completely destroyed. Yep. He just said, that's it, I'm going back to Israel, where he'd had a hobby vineyard, and now he's making some beautiful wines
along the Galilee. We serve Golan Heights Winery and Galil Mountain. So yeah, we believe Zahav has the largest Israeli wine list in the country. That there's that much competition.
Well, it's a phenomenal wine list, and I was salivating because you had some wines I really wanted to try, but I was only having one glass because I was driving the next day, and it was killing me. I actually discovered a Palestinian wine in Chattanooga, Tennessee, where I live from I don't remember. It was like, I took a picture of it. I'll have to send it to you. But it was actually, it was a Palestinian family that owned the restaurant. So in Chattanooga, that's like really strange. It was pretty amazing. We have to wrap it up. I want to thank you because it's been a great show. Again, we've been talking with Michael Solomonoff and Stephen Cook. You've got to go get their book, Israeli Soul. It's really fabulous. But more importantly, go to Philadelphia and check out the restaurants because you will be blown away. And of course, if you're curious, book a trip to Israel. We're going to. Thank you guys. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much
for having us.
And to everybody out there, here's my message to you. Stay insatiably curious. Take care.